Blog Talk Radio.
Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Mr. Edwards, how are you this wonderful evening?
Fine, Mr. Allen. I mean, you know, we were getting to go into fall here in the beautiful upper Midwest, the very liberal enclave of the Twin Cities, the state of Minnesota, if you will. We're just kind of all happy. In fact, I was thinking maybe we could even sing the Song of the South. Song of the South, the song that was always sung as we, you know, lullabied master as the evening came to an end and et cetera. I mean, things are just great here, man. I mean, you know. But we wanted to, Don, right off the bat, start off with a real serious health problem here in the United States, and definitely a very, very serious problem in Black Africa, particularly along the western coast of Africa, Sierra Leone, Liberia, if you will. It's just frightening, the number of Black Africans who are dying and have fallen ill, if you will, to the almost a significant inability to find a cure for Ebola. I saw an article, AP, just a couple hours ago saying that Ebola first came into prominence in 1979. That's just not true, Don. In fact, there was a white doctor by the name of Dr. John Kearns that was on back in late July as the Ebola was beginning to break out, and he is actually the silver bullet, if you will. It was his blood, because he had come down with Ebola in 1973, and it was his blood that was used to perfect the vaccine that's been in place since 1973. So I'm listening to these dates, but this current situation we have in Dallas, Texas, and certainly if anyone is listening from Dallas, if you will, certainly welcome to give us a call, tell us what the situation there is. A number of blunders and accidents, if you will, in Governor Rick Perry's state. The hospital there, Texas Health Presbyterian, made some egregious medical errors, Don, in admitting the individual who I think we all have reason to believe is a Black Liberian, if you will. Who had come to the hospital with symptoms, if you will, of Ebola. They sent him home, which kind of makes you believe that he is a person of color, and then he comes back in an ambulance 2 days later, basically 8 days moving through the population of the Dallas-Fort Worth area, if you will. CDC, the Center for Disease and Control, saying that there's no problem. Headlines in New York Times and other papers saying that we've stopped it and et cetera, which I'm not understanding how they could do that when this this Liberian certainly has come in contact with probably 1,500 people or more, including his flight. Found out, by the way, that he took a flight from Liberia to Belgium, and then from Belgium across the Atlantic into the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I mean, you know, you're talking about at least three airports. You came in contact with a lot of people, man. And it raises the question, there's a lot of discussion going on right now, that the Twin Cities is considered to be an epic center of possible, infection, if you will, and no one wants to say pandemic. I mean, God forbid, you're talking about 4, 5, 6, 15, 20 million people dead. But I thought we were told, Mr. Allen, that there was no way in the world it could get into the United States. I mean, what do you think happened?
Well, I think that someone dropped the ball on it, Mr. was because the stories that I've been checking out here from the CDC and other national news sources, the gentleman's name was released by a family friend named Guy Melish, and this gentleman has been identified as Thomas Eric Duncan. Now, he threw up, according to this story, copyrighted story on YahooNews.com and also the New York Times, he threw up outside of his apartment, and they said that up to 18 people, including 5 children, had contact with him. And after he traveled to the United States from Liberia in late September, the children had gone to school earlier this week, but have since been sent home and are currently being monitored for symptoms. So, the virus, in West Africa, where, over 3,000 people have died in the worst outbreak on record, it's pretty interesting that it's popping up here like that and how, they, like you said, they sent the guy home. He's obviously of color, and I'm getting some, okay, I just got some more information. Someone sent me a link, Mr. Edwards, a list of the Ebola outbreaks. Here it's only listed from 1976 to current 2014, and the massive numbers of deaths from England, Philippines, the United States, and actually in 1990, this is interesting to note, in 1990, the species was RESTV. There were 4 human cases, human deaths, 0. That was in 1990, according to this information that is vetted, looks like, here by the CDC. And I'm going down here. And
That's just troubling, because Dr. John Kearns, who, in fact, that can be recaptured by going into CNN's portfolio archives, he was on, and it was one time interview, by the way, and I think I clearly know why, but he was on. Dr. Kearns, Caucasian doctor who had gone to the Congo around 1971 as a health doctor, health service, etc. He contracted something. They weren't quite sure initially. Then they found out that it was a disease that allegedly had never been seen before, but it had. He came down ill. He came down with all the symptoms of Ebola, including slight bleeding, but certainly a lot of fever and et cetera. He recovered. And in 1974, a couple years later, he was approached by the World Health Organization, and they asked him to take a sample of his blood, and they were already thinking the silver bullet concept, if you will. Lo and behold, he had developed the antibodies, which is crucial. And out of that, they developed the vaccine, which has been used in a controlled situation that has never been made available in Africa to black care, healthcare workers, and et cetera. And that's kind of what got folks in trouble when 2 white health workers, one doctor and one registered nurse, were flown by private aircraft to Emory University there in Atlanta, right down the edge of a very large African-American population. They recovered using a vaccine that, folks wanted to lead us to believe had never been used on humans before, which then raised the question, how did you know how much of a dosage to give them, and et cetera. They were given 3 dosages. I mean, how did you figure all that out? They have recovered and are doing well. There's a gentleman in Nebraska was quietly brought back into the United States, Caucasian. He was given the vaccine. He's recovering. There's a doctor in Charlotte, North Carolina, back in late July. He had contracted the virus. He was flown back. He was in the early enough stages, and because he was a physician, he was allowed to self-medicate. A special unit was set up, if you will. Our quarantine took place, and he has recovered. Now we have this situation in Dallas, and I think we both concur, Mr. Allen, that the individual, did you say that his name, the individual in Dallas, his name has been posted on the internet?
Yes.
Could you give it that name again?
the name is Thomas Eric Duncan, identified by his family friend. The hospital cited the man's privacy as a reason for them not identifying him, and a friend who they left there, Guy Malish, says his name is Thomas Eric Duncan. The New York Times reports that.
Wow. You know,
we always have to tell them New York Times or one of these white papers because they'll say that we made it up, you know?
Absolutely. I know that the Liberian Ministry of Information is the one that indicated how he actually came into the United States through Belgium, as I said, flying from Monrovia to Brussels, and then from Brussels across the Atlantic to the Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. But what's so troubling and frightening, I mean, he was in the country at least, my God, I mean, 15, 16, 17 days, man, before, and himself, you know, tried to have himself admitted to the hospital and was sent back home, and then he collapsed. Do you know that one of the other blunders was that the ambulance that brought him back to Presbyterian Hospital, do you know that it was not decontaminated?
Oh, no.
For 2 days?
I mean, I know that.
It continued to make runs. This is the Los Angeles Times and the Dallas Herald or Dallas Star paper. It was not decontaminated for 2 days. In fact, they're not even telling you now how many individuals were transported in that on other emergency runs.
Mm.
So anyways, this Ebola situation, the CDC is telling us everything is okay. Yet I am aware of plans and preparations that are taking place right here in the Twin Cities because of the large African population, particularly West African population, but we also have a large East African population in the question of both Somalis and a smaller group of Ethiopians, but we have a very, very large number of West Africans, particularly from Liberia, to some degree Sierra Leone, Guinea, if you will. The Nigerians seem to, there is a story coming out of Beijing, it's been out for the last couple of weeks, that the Chinese, who are doing a lot of investment and economic development in West Africa in coordination with the black African countries, had warned the Nigerian government of a kind of a clandestine operation that was taking place. Things began to happen when the United States created the U.S. African Command almost 3 years ago, and American military personnel started showing up in the Central African Republic, if you will, in around Burundi, Uganda, if you will, and Rwanda. And there has been a heavy American medical military presence in that part of the world, and then, of course, back towards the coast. I'm just not sure because it took a long time for the Western powers to decide that they wanted to send assistance because clearly they knew as early as July that the health system in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea was being absolutely overwhelmed, and yet it took a long time, didn't it, for any kind of material assistance and help to come. And that vaccine still hasn't got there, the same vaccine that has cured all of the Caucasian medical personnel. But, I mean, I'm not saying that this is the Tuskegee type of experiment, if you will, in crisis. And for those that don't know what we're talking about, that is one of the most outrageous medical experiments in the history of the United States and modern medicine, and that was the intentional infection of over 235,000 Negroes in and around Tuskegee, Alabama, in the period 1933 to 1938, okay? For those that really did not know, have not been taught it, it's not discussed in their academic settings and et cetera. So we are a country that certainly has the mentality and capability to set the stage for intentional medical infections. In fact, we would refer people to the very outstanding book written a couple years ago entitled Medical Apartheid by a professor of medicine, Mrs. Washington, if you will. So there's concern in the Sutra, but I would warn our West African brothers and sisters here in the Twin Cities that they need to be kind of on guard because the facilities are being set up for quarantine. And, of course, all you have to do to guarantee that what will be done is by declaring a state of emergency or martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to sound like a, you know, a terrorist, if you will, a doomsday predictor or whatever. Terrorism is a popular word nowadays, but there is clearly a concern, and there's been a lot of movement between the Black Continent and the United States, people going back and forth, checking on loved ones and et cetera. So that's something that's out there. This Ebola, the medical profession, the CDC had told us just 2 weeks ago it couldn't happen here, and now it's here. And you're saying also they're reporting that his illness and et cetera, that there was contamination of 60, 70 people right there.
Yeah, right there. And
then three
the
different airports. I mean, that's easily 800 to 1,000 people who came in contact with him. Yeah.
Yep. And then kids at the school. I mean, that's a lot going on there.
Yeah. And depending on how many children were in the home. I'm a little puzzled. You said that the New York Times is saying his apartment, because initially the cover story was that he was visiting friends and he was staying at their home. Now we're hearing about an apartment.
It was what it says here from the New York Times is he had contact with 18 people, including 5 children, had contact with Ebola patient. His whole family was screaming. He got outside and was throwing up all over the place. Resident Mossad of 21 said on Wednesday, describing the chaotic scene for the man was admitted to the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital on Sunday, where he's in serious condition. Outside in public.
Don, you're breaking up a little bit on your connection there.
Okay.
Yeah, they're a little
I said
better.
That,
okay.
Okay, sorry about that. What I said was they had another person here, Mossad, who said he's 21 years old, who said that he was the whole family was screaming. He got outside. He was throwing up all over the place. And before he was admitted in or taken back and admitted to the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital on Sunday.
Right. And Dr. Goodman, who is the medical director at Texas Presbyterian, could not explain why the individual was denied admittance the first time that he showed up. And why it was that 2 days later, an emergency call went out and ambulance brought him there. Boy, that is significant. By the way, the CDC had sent out a national alert
mm-hmm.
about a month ago, almost, indicating what the protocol should be across the United States with anyone who shows symptoms. In just kind of conclusion, you know, our listening audience needs to understand there is a peculiarity with respect to at what point did he contract this. Authorities in Liberia say that when he got ready to board the plane, he was tested. He had no fever or et cetera. He gets on the plane. He makes a very long flight. He gets off the plane. He shows no fever and et cetera, and it's not until 4 or 5 days later that he comes down with the firm symptoms. I mean, where was it that he was infected?
Exactly.
And do we have a situation where we have a presence of Ebola inside the United States that has been here maybe even prior to him coming over from Liberia? I mean, that's just very peculiar.
I would
he showed
have to
no
agree
symptoms.
With you.
Yeah, he showed no symptoms. I think that maybe in the New York Times piece, I know the Los Angeles Times has picked up on that, and I understand one of the London papers have chimed in. To me, as an investigative reporter, I'm troubled by at what point was he infected? Where did he make contact? And in order to be infected, he would have had to come in contact with fluids. You know, in other words, sweat. By the way, you don't have to have a cut or anything on your body. This virus is so penetrating and so deadly that it just at the point it comes into your skin, it goes into your pores and into your system. I'm just wondering, I mean, where did he come into contact to be infected?
That's the $1 million question right there.
Yeah. All right, phone number, Mr. Allen, in case there are any questions. This, the Ebola epidemic in Africa has now descended upon the United States.
Yeah, that phone number, well, phone lines are wide open. You can call us at 347-426-3904. Again, the number is 347-426-3904.
Okay. I hope that our protocols here in the Twin Cities are in place in case there are any cases that emerge here, though there's some reason to believe that there may have been a scare about 3 months ago at one of our hospitals connected with the University of Minnesota, but don't want to, you know, go too far with regards to that because folks will say that we're just making things up. So, anyways, wow, you know, the Ebola, dangerous virus, if you will, of the same family, by the way, as the HIV virus, if you will, known as AIDS. Which is peculiar, isn't it, that you have two such dangerous viruses that come from, quote-unquote, the same family. By the way, HIV was man-made, and I think you're going to find out that Ebola is man-made. Which then raises the question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But, hey, you know, the man will get our minds right and tell us what he wants us to know. You know. But people should certainly be vigilant and alert, if you will, if they see any signs, if they've done any, not even traveling overseas, but if they've done any traveling lately, they need to be very cognizant of their physical situation. This though it's not airborne, as you know, Mr. Allen, it's still a disease that, and by the way, the deaths of 3,000, that is not a correct number. The number, according to the World Health Organization and the United Nations, is more like 10,000.
Wow.
And if you talk to people who still have loved ones and et cetera, particularly in Liberia and places like that, they got 3,000 people back out in the bush that are dead, okay, and have already been buried. So the number is far in excess of 3,000. But that's the way people, governments do when they're trying to head off any fear of a pandemic.
Okay, Mr. Edwards, that means that the reservoir has not been found, you know, for this guy in Dallas or down Texas there. And there's no, actually, I shouldn't say not been found, but just can't be identified because at this point, it could have been picked up anywhere. Someone could have, you know, put it on him, basically. But they don't know, are not releasing the information of his whereabouts, his exact whereabouts. You know, and when he was in Africa, which is a very important piece. So, and how many people are sick?
Well, they tried to initially leave you with the impression that he was in Liberia, but then they kept saying that he does a lot of traveling, which then made you wonder, okay, travels on behalf of whom? I mean, is he a health worker? You know, was he a journalist, if you will, or was he someone that was involved with some aspect of healthcare? I mean, you know, just who was he? And what kind of capabilities does Presbyterian have there? Though it looks like a big, pretty building and et cetera. I've asked some associates who are aware of the assessment and evaluation that goes on in hospitals. The CDC has told us that basically any American hospital of 500 beds or more could handle this, that they can do the necessary quarantining and et cetera. But if you don't even know how to recognize it, which is clearly what happened at Presbyterian when this individual first came there for assistance and they turned him away, with the CDC a month earlier giving out a nationwide alert of how these kinds of things and what the symptoms were, how it should be handled with immediate admission and quarantine.
His Facebook page says that he lives in Accra, Ghana. He's from Monrovia, Liberia, and he attended the
Monrovia.
E. Jonathan Goodrich High School. And I'm looking at pictures of him right here on Facebook.
Okay, and he He's from Ghana. Now, that's interesting. He's from Ghana, but departed from Liberia, which is interesting. Why would he go into an infected zone to catch an airplane to Brussels when he could have easily caught a flight from Ghana, which has not been identified as a red zone at this particular point, though Ghana is in close proximity to those nations we've previously been talking about. Take a look at your world map or your computer maps. Think about that. So he goes from Ghana to Monrovia, catches a flight, flies to Brussels. But he has a home in Ghana, but he also has a home in Dallas, Texas. Is that what we're to understand?
Yeah, that's what we're to understand here. I'm actually looking at it here. I'm trying to figure out here why. It says, why did he come to the United States? To visit family or friends, according to a friend who noted Duncan was, this was Duncan's first trip to America. I'm looking at
his
CNN
first trip
Health.
to America.
Yeah, the family.
And he goes.
Go ahead.
Wow. No. He goes from a minimally contaminated country, that being Ghana, to a country that is in a severe state of infection and medical crises to catch a plane. I don't quite understand that. I mean, looks like we should be getting a better description of what the heck went on. Okay.
Here we go. There's more intel. This was released. Let me just see here. Updated 9:51 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Eastern Daylight Time today. So that wasn't too long ago.
Okay.
It says the New York Times reported Thursday that Duncan had direct contact with a pregnant woman stricken with Ebola on September 15th, day before he left the United States, citing the woman's parents and Duncan's neighbors in Monrovia, Liberia. Newspaper said Duncan had helped carry the ailing woman home after the hospital turned her away because there was no space at the Ebola treatment ward. Boom. Your reservoir right there.
That's it. That's
yep.
it right there. And then he goes from Ghana to now. What? Let me ask the question. The contact with the pregnant woman was in Monrovia or Ghana?
No, Monrovia. They were neighbors in Monrovia, Liberia.
Okay, then why would they give an address for him in Ghana?
That was on his Facebook page, actually, Mr. Edwards. That said, here, let me just go back there and look at that.
Wow. Wow.
He lives, it says he lives in Accra, Ghana, and he's from Monrovia, Liberia.
Okay. So we will just assume, for the purposes of assuming, that he was now residing in Liberia, and some way or another on his Facebook he made reference to accommodations in Ghana for whatever purposes he needed to do that. Okay.
No, you know,
and of course, Ghana is in that general area. In fact, Ghana is between Sierra Leone and Liberia and et cetera. And let's give an example, Nigeria. Okay. You have a host of countries there. Okay. Well, I mean, who are we to, you know, as two journalists in a place called Minnesota, I mean, to question, but of course the man is now here in the United States in under quarantine, may or may not make it, and I think you've just found the host, is the medical term that we use. The host had to be the pregnant woman or medical personnel at the hospital. But here's the thing that also bothers me, is that we have been constantly told that basically the medical services in Liberia have been decimated, absolutely decimated. And if you're saying that the article that New York Times and others are saying that this pregnant woman very well could have already been infected, was Duncan told that when he went to, was it the hospital or was it a private home that he met with her? Or
The New York Times reported that Duncan had direct contact with a a pregnant woman stricken with Ebola on September 15th.
Well, that's confirmation there. That reference, stricken with, he knew that she was infected with Ebola. He was allowed, obviously without the necessary safety features, if you will, gloves, goggles, gloves, and et cetera, to have contact with her, and she had to be omitting significant fluids, unfortunately, and then in a state of pregnancy. My God. Who in the heck was advising him? What was he thinking about?
Well, I don't know, but here, New York Times has a picture of the pregnant woman's brother, who's Sonny Boy Williams, 21. It was hours after he was picked up alive from his home in Monrovia, Liberia. He's dead. And the man who flew to Dallas and was later found to have Ebola virus, identified by Liberian officials as Thomas Eric Duncan, helped Mr. Williams carry his sister, Marceline Williams, 19, who was stricken by Ebola, to a hospital last month. She died the next day.
And is Mr. Williams still alive, or did I mishear you? He has died also?
He has passed, yeah. He's expired.
He just passed in the last, according to the New York Times. Again, this is not Don and Ron, you know, making some jive and BS together. This is the prestigious white New York Times. They say that Mr. Williams has now died in the last couple of days?
Yeah. So my question is, how do we have pictures of these people? You know?
Courtesy of the CIA, Don.
That's very troubling.
That's frightening. That's scary. That's really scary. That they were able to identify individuals to the extent of putting the pictures out of two people that have already expired. And she must have been at a terrible advanced stage to have died, quote unquote, the next day. What were those dates again for our listening audience? Is that he saw her? What was the date again that they gave?
September 15th. Had direct contact.
Well, see, they've told another story, because they said that initially they said he arrived here on the 8th or 9th of September, and then I noticed the date when I saw Dr. Friedman of the CDC yesterday in the emergency broadcast or emergency press conference, they had moved the date up. Now I can see why.
Okay,
I mean, my God, he was already in contact with people who had been thoroughly infected, if you will, and were actually at death's door. And if she died, the day after they got into the hospital, and you wonder what capabilities that hospital had medically. But the problem is with the combination of perspiration, blood, and bleeding from different parts of her body. I mean, and that they actually handled her, he working and accompanying Mr. Williams, her brother. And then he's able to leave the country. I mean, that's fascinating.
That's incredible. That's incredible. Mr. Edwards, we do have a caller.
Let's get the caller.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
How y'all doing tonight?
All right, how are you?
Real good, my brother. What can we do for you?
So, number one, it is pretty unfortunate with the Ebola case, but I think that we live in a country where we have one of the best medical systems in the world, and so I think that we can get a hold on that whole grasp on some quote outbreak, which I don't believe that's what it is yet, an outbreak, and I think we'll be okay. When you hear Republicans screaming and saying that it's coming from immigrants, that it sounds a bit racist to say things like that. So they have to be careful about things that they say. I wanted to bring up the community action situation.
Community action being an agency here in the city of Minneapolis that has had some problems and is now shut down. Go right ahead.
I think that we have to be careful who we start pointing the finger of blame at. I think it's easy to blame Hayden and Ellison when solely for political purposes, of course, when we have no proof that either one of these gentlemen, or Lori Swanson for that matter.
Well, wait a minute, let's have to back up. When you say either one of these gentlemen, you're talking about Senator Hayden and who else?
And Keith Ellison.
You're talking about Keith Ellison. I see. Okay, you hadn't identified Congressman Ellison. Go ahead.
And I think that it's very dangerous to go around asserting that they had something to do, that they had knowledge of this wrongdoing.
Okay, well, so we're clear for our domestic, national, international audience. When you say they, it's primarily been the Minneapolis Star Tribune that has talked about this situation. Is that what we're saying?
Absolutely, and a few of my Republican and a few of my Republican friends have asserted as well that Hayden knew had knowledge of the misappropriations of those funds. We know no evidence of that. There's not one shred of evidence that he knows of that. Now, I think his problem in lies that the Minnesota statute that requires board members have meetings with the select members once a month or something that to that effect, and that they will be held accountable and responsible. So he may have legal worries in that sense, but I don't think that we can assert that Hayden or Ellison knew any wrongdoings of what the president of the community action was doing.
Well, we clearly agree. We, Mr. Allen and myself, clearly agree. In fact, we have talked on this program, we have talked about the importance of due process. That's what due process is about in the United States of America, at least that's what we're told, and that he has not been accorded due process by any stretch of the imagination. But for whatever reason, the major newspaper here in the state of Minnesota decided to go with the story, actually putting more emphasis on the board members, who unfortunately, as you said and correctly, they do have a responsibility once they sign their name to the documents that they are members of the board. They have a responsibility to be due diligent, if you will. And that's where it will probably be a problem, and that's where the Ethics Committee of the Minnesota Senate is going to hear testimony, and, you know, they're going to make a determination. Well, they've got three options, and one of them is to exonerate. The other one is to do nothing, which will lead to exoneration. And, of course, the third is to make a recommendation to the main committee, and then that committee would make a recommendation to the full Senate as it pertains to whatever action would be taken against Senator Hayden. I think that Senator Hayden will prevail. I think that there will probably maybe be an admonishment for not being due diligent, if you will, in his responsibilities by signing on. Notice the word I use. I can't speak for my colleague, Mr. Allen, but we've concurred in our private discussions for signing on as a board member, but not adhering to what the statutory requirements are in here in the state of Minnesota and most other states as it pertains to, you know, again, being due diligent. And that means, you know, making sure that everything is done in an appropriate manner and, most importantly, the expenditures. You know, I think that many of them just paid no attention. Mr. Davis has been the overseer for 24 years, if you will, of the CAP agency. And I just think there was a certain level of trust, unfortunately. And, of course, that's not the first time that that's happened. That's also in another situation and dealing with another controversy that has evolved. And you trust people to do the right thing and to be above board and honest and et cetera. And they betray that trust, and then there's consequence for everybody, particularly in an election year. And if you have the race question at play, I mean, if the Republicans can knock off Senator Hayden, who is the powerful assistant majority leader and a man on the way up, if you will, if they can some way knock him out and knock him out of the box, if you will, and maybe later on Senator Champion in the other issue with the program monies for another community organization, that would be a feather in their cap. And, you know, I think everybody is aware of that. I eagerly await, and then I would turn back to my colleague, Mr. Allen, I eagerly await the hearing. I think that the leadership of the Senate did the right thing by saying it will be a public hearing, and people will be subpoenaed, and they will have to give testimony, and I think the public has a right also to hear that testimony and to make determinations and judgment on that testimony.
Absolutely.
And I would have to agree 100%.
Now, that's in the case of the other entity. In the case of the Community Action Agency, that the Senate really hasn't moved to admonish Senator Hayden. I think that's a situation that's a little bit more difficult, and even the Republicans. I don't think, Mr. Allen, I don't think the Republicans really want to get caught up in that. I think they're concentrating more on this other program, which has been receiving money since 2011.
Yeah, and you know, Mr. Edwards, I went over, I went over the complaint filed by the Subcommittee to Ethical Conduct regarding the actions of Senator Hayden, and I am looking at out of the list of the first seven, let me skip down here. The second, complaint number two. It says Senate Rule number five, complaint number two, number five under two, says Senate Rule 56 provides that members shall adhere to the highest standards of ethical conduct. Okay? And I'm making a point here. Senate Rule number 56.3 provides that improper conduct includes conduct that violates rules of the Senate, violates accepted norms of the Senate behavior, and that betrays the public trust or that tends to bring Senate
into
dishonor.
Repute.
Into repute. Yes.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
If you go into 8, let me see, 9 under complaint number 2, let me just find it. It says, and what they're trying to get at here, I mean, I see what they're trying to do, because it says Senator Hayden's, number 12, Senator Hayden's statement of economic interest filed with the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Disclosure Board lists nonprofit administrator as his profession. Okay, that's number 12.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
What they're trying to say, basically, okay, if you are a nonprofit administrator, then why wasn't this situation with Community Action looked at a little
something
more
that came
closely
across your radar screen, in other words?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, but in reality, if you put the complaint number one and put the complaint number two together and you deal with Minnesota Statute 10A.07, which briefly says provides that a public official who is discharged official duties would be required to take an action or make a decision that would substantially affect the financial interests of those in associated business. And I'll just I'll shorten and capsulize that. It basically said that, you know, you have to have due diligence if you're responsible, or like you said, Mr. Edwards, you signed up or signed in for that particular place. So
yeah,
okay, their angle.
Go ahead, caller. Caller wants to get something in.
Go ahead, caller.
What's your observation?
We can't. Okay, so we know that he was inept in his responsibilities. Okay, but does that make it illegal? Does that mean that he again committed? That he broke any laws? I don't think so. In this political heated climate that we're having right here, Minnesota, which Republicans are losing their edge, that's what this is about. This is about trying to not only besmirch and maliciously malign this man's character, along with Keith Ellison's character, but to make the point of this witch hunt should solely be focused on the president of the Community Action, not on Senator Hayden, okay, and his ineptitude and being on the board, being a board member. He didn't commit a crime. There was a serious, egregious public trust a breach of that with the president. He not only did breach the public's trust, but legally.
Well, not, he's not president, he's executive director.
I'm sorry, in
a situation as sensitive as this, and given the legalities and et cetera, he was not the president of the organization. He was the executive director. But just one of the show we have. correct application. He was the exec director, not the president. The president would be whoever headed the board.
Yeah, exactly. And also, caller, you have to look at Minnesota Statute 317A, which is kind of the oversight of the nonprofit area. And if they filed their article in corporations, almost every nonprofit article in corporations says that board members will not benefit from the activities of the nonprofit. That goes from the local level to the federal level.
Who
and
said
so,
he benefited it?
Well, I'm explaining you the law, the facts. Okay, I'm just explaining the facts. So if there is a slight case of anyone receiving, this includes a bus token. Okay, that's how minimal it goes as far as the law is concerned on this. And I'm not saying he committed a crime, but if you're in charge, if you're on a board and your oversight, you know, I don't know how, maybe Bill Davis hid some stuff that they didn't, maybe he was giving inadequate reports. But what I'm saying is it's not necessarily a crime, but from Keith Ellison all the way over to Hayden, you know, there should have been some questions asked, but I understand hindsight is 2020. So I'm thinking that, you know, Hayden will not, you know, get the screws turned on him on this, but there needs to be some questions answered, and I think he'll do it successfully.
I do, you know, too. I fully concur.
But
caller. We haven't heard all of the evidence. We haven't technically heard all of the allegations and the particulars. Now, I will say this. I will say this to you. There is one piece that you have to keep in mind. And the Star Tribune went to great lengths initially to imply that he had received gratuity and et cetera as regarded the resort in northern Minnesota, except. In his preliminary response to the subcommittee of the Ethics Committee, Senator Hayden pointed out that in accompanying his wife, who, of course, was his representative on the board, paid all costs incurred out of his own pocket. She did not have to do that, was not obligated, because there were gratuities and et cetera for the board. Now, the Republicans are probably going to honor to argue that was a misstep, if you will, and they will, you know, because what these kinds of hearings are all about is the art of quote-unquote concessions, okay?
Exactly.
And so, you know, their angle is to get a concession and an apology to the body, if you will, stand in the well, as they talk in terms of what happens in the Senate, where you stand on the floor of the Senate and you apologize to your colleagues and et cetera. I mean, they're playing any number of angles, but Mr. Allen and I have talked about that we need to hold in advance all reflections other than state over the air what the rules and regulations and the law says until at such time as the hearing takes place. And like I said earlier, sir, I think it's great that the Senate has decided that this will be open to the public, if you will, and that, you know, the public will be the judge. But the ultimate arbitrator here, of course, are his colleagues in the Minnesota Senate. So, I mean, there's no disagreement amongst the three of us that there is real question and suspicion about the vigor. Because let me give you an example back the other way. There were others, and particularly over the last 24 years, there are others that have served on that board and were aware of actions by Mr. Davis that were not consistent with the law, having nothing to do with the rules of the Senate or the legislature, and yet they remain silent, and there is
exactly.
testimony now, and affidavits have been filed with the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota by a former employee, a woman who was the controller, if you will, has done a hell of a job, according to many reliable sources, indicating as early as 1993, 94, and 95, she attempted to warn members of the board and elected officials of inconsistencies and malfeasance by Mr. Davis, and those were rejected. And this woman has, her name is, and we now feel free to indicate it. Her name was Frieda Scobie, S-C-O-B-E-Y.
Mm-hmm.
And she has filed a formal complaint and turned over documents to the Attorney General of the state of Minnesota. And the reason I go to that and to her as a whistleblower, I would also think that we would, on this program, indicate that one of the other, you know, most powerful political leaders, quote unquote, in the state of Minnesota is the my longtime friend, Council President Barb Johnson, who has not stood any of the quote unquote outrageous references, reflections, and et cetera, as the as Senator Jeff Hayden, and even to a lesser degree, Representative Ellison. And yet she is the president of the city council. I've not heard anyone talk in terms of bringing up her on, or bringing her up on charges. And you know, there is no system in place in the city of Minneapolis to bring her before her peers and have her stand in the docket, if you will, et cetera. But she is the council president, a powerful Democratic operative, if you will, a longtime member and a longtime council president, and a member of the one of the most powerful political families in Minneapolis, the Rainville family. And I find it interesting that Mr. Allen, a caller, that no one has raised a question about, well, you know, how should she not be required to explain what it is she knew and when she knew and what she did about it.
Exactly, and thank you. That's exactly my point. Is this is all, we know that this is all to get the Negro, to make sure the Negro looks bad, and because again, I think we're all saying that there absolutely should be some accountability if Senator Hayden, which he has been obliged and much obliged in all of his answering so far, the legal ones that he could anyway, said he had proof to the fact that what you said, Mr. That he could produce proof that he paid for those trips. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and so,
you said that early on. Right, right.
Exactly.
And no one has really disputed that, and the Star Tribune clearly has not said that he could not prove that. But and we're coming up. Mr. Allen, are we going until 10, or what's our...
Oh, yeah, we're rolling out till 10 on this because we got some callers waiting, too.
All right, we'll see what our
call is. I appreciate y'all.
We don't want you to run because we have time.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just puzzled by, and there were others that have been silent. I mean, former council member Natalie Johnson Lee, who also had served in her one term, served with Barb Johnson on the Minneapolis City Council, if you will.
Exactly.
Nothing from her since she was identified as a member representing one of the council members, our good friend, and he's been on this program a couple times. Councilman Bong Yang immediately got off, if you will. There were a couple other council members, gentlemen, I didn't realize were also on there until 5 days after the story broke. They immediately announced that they were removing themselves and et cetera. But the person that really has been quiet and conspicuous by their absence, and I think that he's looking at an indictable situation, indictable in the sense that he probably will be indicted, is Bill Davis. And at one point, Bill Davis was a fair-haired, colored, if you will, representative of the Democratic Party, was held in high esteem, was a significant mover and shaker in the early 1990s with the NAACP of Minneapolis, et cetera. I think he's been extremely quiet with regards to what his role for 24 years was. But as I said, the information provided by Ms. Scobie, I understand, gentlemen, is extremely incriminating, and apparently she had done her homework, and yet here for almost 20 years she had been attempting to get people to take note of what was happening inside of the Community Action Agency. They didn't want to do it. Then there was a falling out between Mr. Davis and the Democratic Party. And by the way, on that particular note, for the naysayers, player haters, and et cetera, this program, Mr. Allen and myself have reached out to William Davis, offering him a chance to come onto this program and talk about some of these things that we're talking about. So we're not once again, shutting anybody down, shutting anybody out. My understanding is, Mr. Allen, that he has not gotten back to us. Is that correct?
That is correct. I left a message for him last week and this week to pick up the phone and call the show. But I, on this note, before we get to this next caller, Mr. Edwards, I just have to say this. In advertising and marketing, if it's happening one place, it's happening 250 more places. And I'm just saying that to say that, okay, let's take Jeff Hayden out of the equation. We all three of us agree on that he did not commit a crime and that he will be exonerated in full. It's just the motions we have to go through. We need some questions answered, period. But let's look at the people that this agency and other agencies are to serve. Were these people better off 5 years ago than they are today? You know, I mean, no. The answer to that question is no. And if you look at these nonprofits, you know, with millions of dollars coming in, millions, okay, and a certain cast of people, yellow, red, black, and white, are stuck in their same economic, employment, and educational situation. They have not grown. And so if you have an agency, I'm not even going to say any names, but if you have Agency X, that's supposed to help with housing. You have Agency Y, who's supposed to do education. Agency Z is supposed to do outreach for veterans, per se. And then you have Agency A, who's supposed to make sure people have food in their houses and get employed and get training, et cetera, et cetera. If none of these things are functioning and you have executive directors of these agencies making between $150,000 and $200,000, $300,000 a year, that's something that needs to be looked at. Something is not working, period.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we agree. Yeah.
But I'll say this and hang up. And
all right.
A couple of things real quick. Number one is the unfortunate thing is that is a great program, Don, that helps a lot of families out, especially.
Oh, I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it's not.
No. I'm just saying that when you said that it's an agency that hasn't been helping, that hasn't turned out good results, I'm just begging to differ, because it is a program that, especially everyone that knows about Minnesota knows how brutal our winters can be, especially in the wintertime. So it's unfortunate that their funds have been frozen, because there are other, especially minority families, who's probably going to be literally frozen because there's not many other programs to run to.
Hold it there, Mr. Caller. Anyway, Mr. Edwards, you were a corporate America executive for many years downtown with the power company. Now, if this situation would have came up, what would have you suggested the government do?
Well, as an executive at the time that this program was put in place, and in fact, in my role as a as an executive at Northern States Power Company, which was the forerunner to what is now Xcel, I would have immediately recommended to my superiors that we approach some of the nonprofits and ask them to serve as satellites, so that people would not have to be going way out to St. Louis Park to drop off their applications and go back and forth to be vented and et cetera. I would have made that offer, if you will, put them in place, gave them immediate training on how to handle the application process, how to interact with us, quote unquote, at Northern States Power Company, familiarize our people with these agencies, and set up a mutual system, if you will, of assistance, if you will, so that this would not happen. But I have to disagree with the caller. The federal government is not going, the state of Minnesota is not going to allow any hardship to come to these folks as it pertains to fuel assistance, specifically fuel assistance. They politically just can't, if you will. So that's not going to happen. But I was surprised that organizations such as the Urban League, if you will, and some of the other nonprofits, particularly those that are in the weatherization business, if you will, did not immediately step up in the last 10 days and indicate that they were prepared to step into the breach, familiarize themselves, be appropriately trained, if you will, so that people would not have to go, you know, 30 miles to drop off an application and come back two or three times to be verified and et cetera. That would have been the way, sir, that I would have handled it many years ago when I was at Northern States Power Company, and specifically in that, as I said earlier, I was one of the crafters of the weatherization payment program, if you will. That came from myself and a gentleman by the name of Al McLean, retired, now living in Colorado, if you will. Though that was our concept. It was accepted by the corporation, got a lot of funding, if you will. And so that's the way I would approach it. I don't see the kind of offering that the caller that we had on was talking about as it pertains to dealing with the hardships that are already being imposed upon the citizens that are very dependent. I saw a gentleman on TV. I mean, he pointed out that for 15 years he's been coming to Community Action for assistance, and God knows when you look at some of the utility bills, particularly gas and et cetera, that they need that kind of help. And we were very multi-purpose at NSP because we also had the gas franchise. We were the electric company for everything, and we had the gas franchise in the city of St. Paul. And so we were cognizant and well aware of what needed to go into making sure that the payment programs and et cetera worked. I don't see that kind of thinking at this point, but, you know, maybe it'll evolve at some point, gentlemen. Okay. Thank you, caller.
Thank you. All right. We have another caller, Mr. Edwards.
Go ahead, caller.
You're live on the air.
I'm live on the air.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I'm a frequent
for the
caller.
Good to hear your voice.
This is Mr. M. And yes. One of the first things that I want to say is today is a beautiful day for me because this is the day that the chains are taken off of me. I don't have to work no more, okay?
Oh, you
it's
retired.
It's on now. Okay.
The wicked witches
have no more say over me anymore.
All right.
So we're on. And Mr. Edwards, you may see me at some of the meetings that you're at in attendance as a junior watchdog to try to get this thing in check. But a couple of comments I wanted to say about, you know, where the program has been. It's a very, 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 very informative program, especially, you know, some of Mr. Allen's recent comments about the rules of order of the particular organization that Mr. Davis was in charge of is Community Action. Is that correct? Is that the name of it?
Community Action. That's right. CAP 8.
Community Action. And getting down to what the responsibilities of board members are, and see, there are rules of order that, see, the public really has no idea of what the responsibilities day to day or what these individuals are supposed to do with the monies they receive and how they're distributed, how their behavior is. I mean, actually, it even extends to people, politicians, even, you know, senators and representatives on our House of Representatives. See, these individuals have other jobs. That's not their only job. See, they're doing two or three other things in addition to that. And I think that, you know, a lot of those things may have some conflict or whatever with the thing they're supposed to be doing with the public in the Senate. But see, the general public doesn't know of those things.
Uh-huh.
General public doesn't know anything more than what they see in the Johannesburg Times, what they see on the WCCO, what they see. You know, and so your program is doing a lot, I think, to really inform people of the inner workings, and you're not making judgments. Hello?
No, we're not. Thank you. Right, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
From what I hear, you're really trying to have the dialogue that the community needs to really be educated on what is really going on with these organizations, not the sugar-coated, what was that donut thing that used to be here? I can't think of the name, but now those glazed donuts. They give you the pablum, they give you that, but that's not what really is going on, and that's you guys are really making an effort to make that happen. But my opinion as far as community action and some of the board responsibilities are, one, I think as you gentlemen have pointed out, these things that they're uncovering and talking about now, these things go back 20 years or more.
That's right, that's right.
You know,
right.
So this is...
We just named early on this program a very significant whistleblower who actually was a former employer. In fact, it was the controller who attempted 20 years ago to talk in terms of what was happening on the inside. And because of the political favor that Mr. Davis enjoyed within the Democratic Party, and because during that whole period of time the administration of this city was controlled by the Democrats, it was dismissed, and then ultimately she had to move on to another job and et cetera. But apparently she maintained, according to the information now coming out of Attorney General Gloria Swanson's office, she maintained relationship with past and current employees, so she continued to gather a mound, a wealth of evidence against Mr. Davis, and shared that. And it's not a surprise, gentlemen, that it was just less than 24 hours after she presented her packet to the Attorney General, and I understand to the federal government, that the raid took place. I mean, you know, you may want to try to dismiss the woman, but you can't dismiss the timing. And it was quite clear because they were there, the agents and et cetera from the Department of Human Resources and from the Department of Commerce. Gentlemen, they were there at 8 o'clock that morning, and what they did was waited for the staff to open the doors, and then they just stormed on in. In fact, they brought... gentlemen, the auditor, the chief auditor of the Department of Human Services, according to news stories and press releases, they brought the main man, and he came in and started indicating what was to be taken. They took every computer, every drive, and et cetera. They took every piece of paper that they could get their hands on, and now they are doing, gentlemen, what we have oftentimes referred to, they are doing a forensic audit. Yeah. And I think that's the reason now there's silence from Mr. Davis and what support is he should normally have, I guess, because they know that the folks got all those documents. And they're also looking at bank accounts. And by the way, the Department of Taxation as well as the feds, because you got to understand,
come,
the feds have already told him that he owes them $800,000.
When they
so
come,
all of us are mature enough to know what that means.
That's
okay.
A done deal when they come. But see, by the time, I don't want to, please, stop me from, you know, this is no levity in this, really, because people are at stake. But what I want to say is, by the time these things get to the news and get to thrown around the papers, see, it's a done deal. See, by the time they report on it, see, they should have been reporting on this 15, 20 years ago. Okay,
that's right. That's
you know, they're late into the game of this thing. So, but by the time it gets to that, I mean, it's pretty much a done deal. And Mr. Davis's silence, I think, is just you know, I mean, the man still has rights to defend himself. I mean, he still has the right to, you know, present his side, which he claims he presented a side of 112 pages of documents that were ignored. Now,
that's what he said. I mean, that was interesting.
But
yet
I think
when asked to provide for our listening audience, when asked to provide that 112-page document to the paper,
exists,
to the local paper, he declined.
Well, if it exists, the people in the raid got them, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, for him to decline after being quoted twice over a three-day period that he had responded in a 112-page document. And then the star finally got around to asking him to provide them with a copy. You know they already have a copy from DHS. But he said that he, at this time, on the advice of counsel, would not provide. I mean, it would seem to me that those answers would be crucial because they talked about trips to Russia, if you will, South Africa in the 1990s. I well remember him joining a delegation from the Twin Cities, if you will, and then going on to Moscow. And as such, I'm not sure what kind of community action was going on in Moscow, but, you know, whatever it was, they were staying at five-star hotels and et cetera. And then, of course, the cruises, the trips to the Bahamas, the trips to Palm Springs, the Desert Springs, to Fort Lauderdale, to Miami, you know what I mean?
And then what about his fiance,
I mean, that was a little bit much.
What about massages? I mean, but the point being, I mean,
I need a massage.
$900 for spas. I mean, that boy.
Some of these things.
$3,000 just for food. I mean, you know, man, people eat good, man. You know.
some of these things. Again, we don't know what other organizations do. We don't know things like what, you know. I mean, there are things like the federal government spending $500 for a paperclip. Okay.
That's right.
There are things that we don't know. See, my dad used to always say, when money's involved, strange things always happen.
Yeah. $1,400 for a screwdriver. Yeah. All
so,
right,
you know,
but like we may have a couple more calls, but any more observations, Prib? We appreciate it.
I just want to say that, again, you know, even these organizations – like community action, whatever. I think we, and I'm going to talk about Black American people, we really have to be more diligent about what we do with our lives when we're here on this earth. I mean, we cannot continue to have our hand out everywhere we turn, and waiting for somebody to do something for us. We really have to begin to do for self. We really have to begin to realize that our generation ends at some point, and our role becomes at a certain point to help the next people do theirs. This is how wealth is generated in this country. This is how
absolutely.
This is how people continually, this is how races and other races continue to get ahead of the African American, because we have no concept. We continue to wait for our reward after we're gone. We continue to live our lives to say, well, when I get to heaven, when I get there. You know, and I'm not condemning, and I'm not making any statement on spirituality, because I'm a very spiritual person myself. I believe that there's someone that created this. There's somebody greater than you and I that have done this. I believe
Absolutely.
I also believe that we have to realize that our time on this earth is limited, and that if we have loved ones, if we have kids, our role becomes to help them help the next ones. That's all I have to say.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Em. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Allen, that number again, and if we have any callers, let's get them in.
Sure, that number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And you're listening to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio. Yeah, Mr. Edward,
coming
you know,
to you from the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, if you will. Any updates that we have, Mr. Allen? I was wondering how things were going on the Viking Stadium. I understand that we would have a significant, at this point, we should have a significant workforce with two-thirds of the hours that have been worked on the stadium going to, well, minorities, which means Caucasian women, but there is supposed to be a separation of hours for people of color. We must be... Boy, there must be a lot of wealth being generated in the community as we speak, right?
Yeah. I mean, everybody seems to be doing wonderful here. So,
yeah.
I'm just looking here.
I understand that M.A. Mortensen, the big general contractor, has awarded some contracts for services well done to at least one African-American company. And
mm-hmm.
So that's going to be interesting. I'm not sure what the work to be performed is, but apparently envelope was handed, and there will no longer be any criticism of anything that is not happening there at the Viking Stadium. We estimate, by the way, with our forensic people, that almost probably close to 2 million hours at an average of $27 an hour has been worked by people of color, Mr. Allen, on the stadium.
Oh, I mean, I haven't drove down there, Mr. Edwards, in a couple weeks, but I've been seeing some reports that they've been sending out. And I'm sorry, I was just, I was just shook by something I just saw on the Star Tribune. I apologize, but we'll get to that in a minute. But yeah, the stadium is, you know, I've also, you know, confirmed that I've heard, you know, that some of our community leaders or freelancers, as I call them, have gotten real quiet. And I guess, you know, it's alleged that one of them, and we don't have to name them, you know, but they know who they are. They're listening. Got a nice little cleanup contract from M.A. Mortensen. And,
oh, to do a little cleanup in and around the site?
Yeah.
Picking up debris and sweeping up debris and such. Well, that's always a, that doesn't take a lot of skilled labor unless you're talking about running mechanical machines. But then, you know, you can basically train a person on how to do that because technically it's like driving a car with you know, manual gear shifts and et cetera. So, well, that's great. And so, like I said, though, I say it again for a challenge, that in excess of 2 million hours have been worked by people of color on the stadium at an average of $27 an hour. So y'all just figure that out, man. That's a nice chunk of money. It's going to be a beautiful Thanksgiving and Christmas for our black community, right?
But what
was it you saw in the Star Tribune, Don? I saw you kind of hold it up there. What is that?
Mayor Hodges joins White House effort to aid minority males.
Oh, yes. There had been some preliminary discussion out of the Beltway. Yeah, she is in Washington.
Okay, I'll stop.
Apparently at some conference in which that is allegedly happening, if you will. That's tomorrow morning's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, no, this is actually printed on September 30th, 2014 at 7:47 p.m.
Yesterday then. Okay.
I just went back to Star Tribune.
So that was in this morning's paper,
the
Minneapolis Star Tribune. If it was posted last night, it would be in this morning's paper. Well, that's great. That's right, because she's going to be working with my brother's keeper.
Exactly. My brother's keeper.
That's what the story says, that she'll be working with and putting tremendous effort into the program My Brother's Keeper.
I'm telling you, young black youth and white women don't mix that often. They don't mix good. It turns out to be a volatile cocktail. So,
Yeah. Well, you know, you look forward to the program. I know that there's a lot of discussion going on about dealing with the crime problem, et cetera. By the way, there will be a press conference on Friday. There will be a press release tomorrow by the MPD indicating how they have tied together some homicides and acts of violence, including the most recent shooting at MCHC and some of the unabated violence that quote-unquote, is going on. And so that should be very interesting. And I think, Mr. Allen, that there will be a press conference on Friday following up the press release and the announcement and talking in terms of, you know, different major cases and et cetera that have taken place. So, I mean, so things are just kind of moving, you know, in a significant manner. The phone lines are open for any observation or question any caller may have. I understand there's been some criticism. Let's get the caller. Mm-hmm.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Don and Ron?
Yeah,
yes, Don and Ron, Larry.
Yeah, recognize your voice. How you doing, Omaha? Mm-hmm.
Just some observations.
Mm-hmm.
The only mistake I think that Bill Davis made is that he didn't codify those things that other agency has done. Hennepin County has spent over $100,000 for a swimming pool for one of the
mm-hmm.
people who take
mm-hmm.
our black kids.
Mm-hmm.
There, all the other agencies have made loans to individuals and directors and board of directors.
Uh-huh.
Mr. Davis did not do is to structure his organization in such a way that it was codified
uh-huh.
and that he would not have any blowback.
Uh-huh.
his bylaws and other aspects of his organization should have been adjusted and modified such that all the things he did could have been allowable. But since he has not, and his organizational structure was not structured to take advantage of some of the things he took advantage of, he may have some liability. He will not. He has board insurance, so board insurance will probably take care of any indebtedness that he may owe the organization. The problem you have is not Mr. Davis. The problem you have is the board. The board has the responsibility, as both you and Ron knows, of making sure those things are in place. And if you decide to be a board member and join these boards, so to speak, you have to make sure you understand how organizational structures are done. The mistake you have is that the board was not up to speed, and they have no organizational structure that allowed them to that allowed them to do the kinds of things that Mr. Davis done. And that is, in fact, the real, as we say in the ghetto from Omaha, the booger with the sugar. That is the biggest mistake that they made. They did not structure their organization sufficiently to allow some of the kinds of things that the organization had done.
Right, yeah, you said it. So they should have structured their bylaws many years ago, because the CAP agency has been around since 1967. So they should have structured it that and have allowed the executive director to have received an unrefundable loan to get a new car, pay for trips to Russia, South Africa, et cetera. That if the board would have done that and the bylaws would have reflected that, then for 24 years, he would have been safe and protected. Yeah, I agree.
That is correct. The other thing that, you know, he's not a business person, so you can't, you know, you can't, you know, you can't get an apple off a pear tree. When you have 54-55% of your budget going toward administrative expenses
is
a sign of just a poor business decision.
Okay.
And these people join these boards for any kind of social gratification it may have, but really don't know what they're doing on the board. And they should have been, they would have been better off doing something else other than joining these boards. They don't do anybody any good. They don't do the community any good, and they don't do themselves any good. Now, if they didn't have the expertise, that's one thing, but not acquiring the expertise is another thing. If they didn't know what they're doing, they should ask somebody. My experience in the courtroom with my profession, the first thing the judge asks you, who did you talk to?
Who did
you counsel with?
If
you're out there just making those decisions willy-nilly and not counseling with anybody, if Natalie wanted to join the board and representing Gong Yang, or Faye wanted to join the board.
Let me ask you this question. How should Bill have restructured his bylaws and et cetera to have dealt with the issue of the training and employment programs that were also under his auspices, in which, unfortunately, the audit showed that 96% of the trainees, kind of sounded like another organization that we know, that 96% of his trainees were never employed. How should his bylaws reflected the acceptance of those kinds of results? Anything?
Well, what he should have done is to make sure that he understood the program in which he was trying to administer. The worst thing you can do is to take on don't know anything about.
Because we've got about 5 minutes. But don't you think that after 24 years you'd have enough seasoning? I'm kind of like you, if you're a chef and you've been cooking barbecue for 24 years, that you would certainly at some point maybe acquire a talent to be able to season them ribs, if you will, to the extent that they would show the proper seasoning. Don't you think after 24 years, old homeboy should have had a...
What you do in the 24 years, you have 1 year over 24 times. You don't reach out. A lot of these folks who want to represent us live in isolation. Other folks that they want to come to North Minneapolis or the inner city and represent us, and they're scared to walk down Lake Street and they're scared to walk down West Broadway.
Okay.
So how can they represent us, the poor people,
okay.
the bottom third?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they had 24 years, but they did 1 year over 24 times. And as
yeah.
long
Let
as it wasn't
question,
harming.
Larry, as pertains to Mr. Davis, do you think that he'll be indicted by either
no.
state or federal jurisdiction? What do you think?
I don't know all the laws, but my initial reaction is based on those people who do audits of these organizations, that the kinds of stuff that Mr. Davis did happens all the time. It's a common practice in most of the organizations, so there's nothing unique about what he did. I don't know what other kinds of issues are back there, so I don't have all the facts, but I would doubt it very seriously that he would be facing any kind of criminal. What they will do is sue him to death, both
uh-huh.
Civilly and financially. They'll just
uh-huh.
make him spend a whole bunch of money chasing Don Quixote's windmill.
Okay.
If he's not broke now, he'll be broke when it's all over with. That's what's going to happen to him.
Uh-huh.
He's going to need
okay.
to put
and then
up.
They'll put him on the mule backwards and send him off across the Spanish coastal plains.
Well, a wooden guy with feet of clay, they'll put some shoes on him and send him down the road.
Yeah, I want to put him on the donkey backwards and send him out across the Spanish coastal plains. If you're going to make him die.
Well, these guys never ingratiate themselves with the community. That's part of the problem. When you want to
yeah.
be greater than, better than, more important than those people you're trying to serve, there's a problem with that.
Okay.
You know, I have a doctor friend of mine says he only dresses about one step above the farmers he serves. He wears plaid.
Yeah, well, he's a smart rural doctor. All right, Larry, appreciate it, man. We're getting ready to break away. In fact, time is running out. Thanks for calling.
Yep,
all right.
Thank you,
Mr. Allen, you still there with us? Looks
yes,
like
sir.
We're pretty much up there. What's the time frame look like? Yeah. We don't have anything else. We got about 3 minutes, so, Don, is there any other
yeah.
call, just in case we don't want to leave anybody out there?
Well, you know, let's
do we have any other caller?
Let's see if our old friend want to talk here. Ms. Barb, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fabulous. This show tonight has just, I mean, breathless. I'm speechless. You've gone from subject to subject, tied them together. Well, I am back in the mortuary business. And for full disclosure, ran against Keith Ellison for the 2008 congressional election, and have been watching closely what's been happening in our community. But I'm back again at funeral service, and I wanted to say you guys touched the Ebola problem, as sad as it is. But I wanted to also say, because we only have 3 minutes left, that an edict was put out this morning in Atlanta. All 6,000 funeral homes were given precise direction on how to treat Ebola, the deceased of anyone who died with the disease. So a couple callers ago said that, you know, and I really appreciated that, he said that we could get a handle on things pretty easily because we're in the American medical system. But I want to just say that Atlanta's gearing up for some things that are pretty strange, so I think we should keep an eye on that.
And we should also keep an eye on here in the Twin Cities because of our large West African population. We, you know, we first of all, congratulations. Good to see you back in the mortician science and services, if you will.
Thank you.
I find it very interesting, some of the edicts, quote-unquote, declarations that are being sent out that almost border on a state of emergency, if you will.
Yeah.
We'd like for you to, you know, maybe join us a little bit earlier next Wednesday. We need to have a little bit more in-depth about the Ebola situation and maybe some of the safeguards that people may want to familiarize themselves with because I'm not believing what the CDC is saying. I just don't think that this thing is as controllable as they're trying to BS us. But we expect to hear from you next Wednesday, Barb, have maybe a in-depth conversation because people really need to know how dangerous and perilous this Ebola outbreak is. Thanks. Appreciate it. We'll be looking to hear from you next Wednesday.
You're welcome.
All right.
Thank you,
dear. All right. Good to have Ms. White back in the mortician's business. We lost a lot when we lost Mr. Estes, if you will, so we certainly need that. Brother Allen, I look like we're probably ready for Little James Brown to take us on home.
Yeah. All right.